Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on extremist traits when we come back. Well, when I'm asked who I would recommend for a lawyer, I always recommend Jerry Spence of Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And if you can't afford Jerry, my second choice then would be you. That's right, you. That's because you're the best guy to represent your own interests in court. After all, you were there, weren't you? You did it, or you didn't do it. You know who else was there. You know what was said, and you know who said it. You know who is lying, and you know who is telling the truth. You know. But your lawyer doesn't know, and he doesn't know any more than you tell him. And besides that, nobody likes a lawyer anyway. The abhorrence of the profession of lawyering is documented throughout Anglo-Saxon history. Shakespeare's Dick the Butcher in King Henry IV exclaimed, "The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers." Charles Dickens wrote, "If there were no bad people, there would be no good lawyers." Poor Richard, in his almanac, said, "God works wonders now and then. Behold, a lawyer, an honest man." So scorned were lawyers by the colonists that they were depicted as lawyer birds with their long bills and lawyer fish, always slippery. Both Massachusetts and Rhode Island prohibited lawyers from serving in their colonial assemblies. Brigham Young, upon establishing his utopia in the Utah desert, characterized lawyers as a stink in the nostrils of every Latter-day Saint. And he described the courtroom as a cage of unclean birds, a den and kitchen of the devil. Early in the 19th century, the Baptist preacher John Leyland attacked a host of lawyers who infest our land like the swarms of locusts in Egypt that eat up every green thing. Well, representing yourself in court or at trial is protected by the Sixth Amendment and three rules. And the three rules are, don't say anything, keep quiet, and then shut up. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that number, 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free. And our courtroom strategy and procedure school is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, we've been talking about extremist traits. The guy that wrote this treatise over here is a guy by the name of Wilcox, Laird Wilcox. It's about an 8-page document here. The webpage, you can get a copy of it at www.webtattoo.com. It's all one word, www.webtattoo.com. Quite a interesting little insight here as to what is it that we would look for to identify an extremist. Well, from a psychologist's point of view, these are the traits that we find that extremists exhibit. And I pointed out that in the first seven, George Bush exhibits all seven of those extremist traits, like character assassination. He practices that. Name-calling and labeling, irresponsible sweeping generalizations, inadequate proof for assertions, the tendency to view their opponents and critics as essentially evil, and a Manichaean worldview. Number eight, Wilcox goes on to say, is that this may, that is, advocacy of some degree of censorship or repression of their opponents and or critics. And this reminded me, when I saw number eight, the advocacy of some degree of censorship reminded me of Patriot Act I and Patriot Act II and this constant incessive secrecy of the Bush administration. I mean, they're paranoid. If you thought Nixon was paranoid, this guy Bush has got to be twice the paranoid that Richard Nixon was. Everybody's out to get them. And they have this cult of secrecy around the White House. And then they're spying on us. They don't want us to know what's going on in the government, but they want to know about us. And so they've got the various government agencies spying on us. And then they went to Congress and got acts enacted so that they could spy on us with the approval of the Congress, with the approval of the law. And what that calls for is advocacy of some degree of censorship or repression of their opponents and or their critics. Remember that woman that was criticizing Bush? I've forgotten her name. Cindy Sheehan, I believe it was. And her boy got killed over in Iraq, and she was bummed out about that. And she went down to Crawford, Texas, and she wanted to talk to the president. He not only wouldn't talk to her, but they had those people kept back, I don't know, a mile or two or 3 miles from the ranch. And then when Bush goes out on a speaking tour, he hadn't done that for a long time. Now, his approval rating, the last time I saw, was down to 27%. I think Nixon's was down to 23%. So he's got a little bit more to go here to catch up with Tricky Dick. But he does that. He has the Secret Service and the FBI and the local police keep all of their critics across town on the other side of town out of sight and out of mind. And that's this number eight. This may include a very active campaign to keep the opponents from media access and a public hearing, as in the case of blacklisting, banning, and quarantining dissent spokespersons. They may actually lobby for legislation against speaking, writing, teaching, or instructing subversive or forbidden information or opinions. No free speech here. They may even attempt to keep offending books out of stores or off of library shelves, discourage advertising with threats of reprisals, and keep spokespersons for offensive views off the airwaves or certain columnists out of the newspapers. In each case, the goal is the same, kind of information and control. Extremists would prefer that you listen only to them. They feel threatened when someone talks back or challenges their views. Well, if that doesn't fit our President George Bush, then I guess none of these would fit. And it's my contention that George Bush is an extremist and a sociopath, and on top of that, he meets all 20 of these standards or these tests for an extremist. I'm not sure that Osama bin Laden meets all of these tests, all of these indices. He may. But then this last one here, what you do with your opponent is you keep him off the air. You don't want him to express his views. I saw the other day that the Al Jazeera television station or television network, which comes out of Abu Dhabi or someplace in the Middle East, in one of the Emirates, they want to put it on the air here in the United States in English. And, well, God, that stirred up a hell of a stink and in short order. Why, people were saying, well, we don't want to listen to those guys. Why not? I mean, if they're liars, we ought to be able to discern their lies in short order. If they're telling us the truth, then why shouldn't we listen to them? What have you got to fear from free speech? I mean, if your opponent over here is wrong, if your opponent is a liar, if he misrepresents the truth, well, then shouldn't we expose it for what it is? But that's not what they're talking about. They're talking about banning them. We're not going to let them, we're not going to give them the time of day, and that's number eight. Now, number nine calls for this. It's the tend to identify themselves in terms of who their enemies are and whom they hate and who hates them. Well, doesn't George Bush identify himself in terms of who his enemies are? He identifies his enemies and then tells us, well, now you're either for them or you're for me, you know, one or the other. See, he says, I can't be neutral. I can't take one side or the other. I can't be objective. I couldn't listen to the other guy over there. I don't follow that. In fact, this commission just, what was it called, the Iraqi or the Iraq Study Commission with Baker, and he gave out this report, you know, and they said, we ought to be over there talking to the Iranians and the Syrians. We ought to get into a dialogue over here and talk to these guys and find out what their bitching life is. What are they complaining about? Now, you know, the Iranians have a point of view. The Iraqis have a point of view. The Egyptians, the Al-Qaeda guys, and the Saudis, and the Americans, and the Canadians. You know, everybody's got a point of view. And I think one of the best things that we ever got, one of the best pieces of advice that we ever got was from our God that told us to butt out and mind our own business and keep to ourselves. Our first president, George Washington, said, don't make entangling treaties and commitments with these nations in Europe. Butt out, mind your own business. And of course, we Americans haven't been able to do that, and the more we mess with other people and we butt into their business, the more problems we seem to have. And to back up that statement, have you noticed how many terrorist attacks have been going on in Stockholm, Sweden, or in Copenhagen, Denmark? And then compare that with London, England, and compare that with the United States. Now, you'll notice here that the Al-Qaeda people, they're not picking any fights with the Swedes or the Swiss or the Danes. Although they got a little upset about some Danish guy over there. Now, here's an extremist trait. You'll notice that these Danes over there, they came up with what they thought Muhammad, the prophet, looked like as a terrorist. And it wasn't very complimentary to Muhammad and the fundamentalist Muslims over there just went berserk, didn't they? Well, that sounds to be pretty extreme to me, or pretty extremist, all right. So George Bush has got a point there. Yeah, it does sound like it's kind of extremist. But on the other hand, you don't see that the Muslims are raising hell with those people that don't raise hell with them. And the Icelanders and the Greenlanders and the Swiss and the Swedes and the Norwegians and the Finns and everybody that butts out of and doesn't stick their nose into those Arabs' business doesn't seem to be having any problems. And before we started sticking our nose into the Middle East and butting in and meddling in their affairs, we didn't have any problems with them either. That was just another observation that I've made. And just down here on the local Joe Sixpack level, just walk into a bar anywhere. And just when you see a couple of guys that are having a conversation, just walk up to these two guys sitting at the bar, minding their own business and talking, and butt into their conversation and start messing with them. Just test it and find out. And see if you don't get a bloody nose. And then if you do get a bloody nose, then test it another way. Next time you walk in the bar and you see two guys talking at the bar, butt out of their conversation, mind your own business, sidle up to the other end of the bar and order a drink, sit down, shut up, and drink your drink, and I'll bet you those two guys won't mess with you. Just test it. The more you mess with people, the more they tend to mess with you. And America and Americans have a big habit of butting into everybody else's business. And I guess that's the price you pay for greatness, the price you pay for being the world's preeminent nuclear power or the world's preeminent economic power. But then don't complain about it when you get your nose bloodied. It's the way life is. You want to butt into somebody else's business every once in a while, you're gonna end up with a bloody nose. It's been my experience anyway. Well, according to extremists, many become emotionally bound to their opponents. They tend to identify themselves in terms of who their enemies are and whom they hate and who hates them. And accordingly, extremists may become emotionally bound to their opponents, who are often competing extremists themselves. It could be that we've got competing extremists. That's a wild new concept. That's number 9, competing extremists. And because they tend to view their enemies as evil and powerful, they tend perhaps subconsciously to emulate them, adopting the same tactics to a certain degree. For example, anti-communist and anti-Nazi groups often behave surprisingly like communists and Nazis. Anti-Ku Klux Klan rallies often take on much of the same character of the stereotype of the Ku Klux Klan rallies, including the orgy of emotion, the bullying, the screaming epithets, and even acts of violence. To behave the opposite of someone is to actually surrender your will to them, and opposites are often more like mirror images that, although they have left and right, reverse look and behave amazingly alike or similarly. I've noticed that. You take these skinhead rallies, and you know they'll be marching around here and then. And then you get the blacks and the Jews on the other side, and they act just like the Nazis. Man, you couldn't tell the two apart. Just a bunch of screaming mobs of people screaming and yelling at one another. Nobody ever listens. Nobody ever goes deep enough to find out, well, what are these people talking about and what's their complaint in life? I often wondered, you know, is that why we got into this war with the Iraqis over here? Because we were competing extremists with the competing extremists, the extremist Americans competing with the extremist Al-Qaeda. Number 10, he says, the tendency toward argument by intimidation. Extremists tend to frame their arguments in such a way as to intimidate others into accepting their premises and conclusions. To disagree with them is to ally oneself with the devil, or to give aid and comfort to the enemy. They use a lot of moralizing and pontificating, and they tend to be very judgmental. This shrill, harsh, rhetorical style allows them to keep their opponents and critics on the defensive, and it cuts off troublesome lines of argument, and it allows them to define the perimeters of the debate. And I noticed that they called the Democrats the cut-and-run party. Did you notice the names that they were using in the 2004 election? The Jews do that. If they disagree with you, they call you a racist and an anti-Semite. That's the first two epithets that come out of their mouth. Racist and anti-Semitic. Which may apply in some cases, and in some cases it may not. But then you don't ever have to get down to the merits of the argument, do you? And that's what I see going on over here in Palestine with the Jews and the Palestinians. Looks like you've got competing extremists yelling and screaming at each other. I mentioned this not long ago that, you know, we're talking about peace when there is no peace. There's no peace in the world today. There hasn't been any peace in the world yesterday, and there isn't going to be any peace in the world tomorrow. And that's because war makes money. Peace doesn't. There's no money in peace, but there's lots of money in war, strife, and contention. Neither side really wants peace. Both sides want war because that's where the money's at. If peace broke out in the world, why, we would have a national collapse. Our economy would collapse. What in the hell would Boeing and Raytheon and Halliburton do if there was no wars? No war, no preparation for war. What would you do with Lockheed Martin? What would you do with the SR-71 and B-52 bombers and F-16 Tomcats? What the hell do you need it for? You need it for war. You don't need it for peace. Can you think of the tens of millions of people that would be thrown out on the street, unemployed, if peace broke out in the world? Boys and girls, the last thing in the world that we want or need or could stand is peace. So let's quit talking about peace which would close the military base around your neighborhood and cause all this unemployment and all this sadness and heartache in your neck of the woods. Can you imagine what you people would be doing up at Fort Leonard Wood if they closed that base? Or in Fort Knox, Kentucky? Now we got competing extremists over here, but the extremists aren't all of them are not in Iraq. We got a couple of them in Washington, D.C. Number 11, the use of slogans, buzzwords, and thought-stopping cliches. For many extremists, shortcuts in thinking and in reasoning matters, or reasoning matters out, seems to be necessary in order to avoid or evade awareness of troublesome facts and compelling counterarguments. Extremists generally behave in ways that reinforce their prejudices and alter their own consciousness in a manner that bolsters their false confidence and sense of self-righteousness. I noticed the president rejected, well, he hasn't done so verbally, but he has criticized the Baker Commission report on Iraq and said, well, we can't accept all of these, but we're going to give them real serious consideration. See, the president has his own righteous standards that he believes in, and it's stay the course, stay the course, stay the course. I asked this question in the last program. Stay the course for what reason? Where are we going when we stay the course? Let's stay the course for 25 years in Iraq. At the end of 25 years, where will we be then? Well, maybe the extremists will give up and quit. But if you take a look at extremists, and assuming that these insurgents are in fact extremists, the extremists in Vietnam never quit. They kept after it for about 25 or 30 years until they finally defeated the French and the Americans. Now, you got peace in Vietnam today, but you couldn't have peace as long as you had the French and the Americans in there. Did you notice that? I heard the other day we're talking about this thing of if you leave Iraq, can you imagine the chaos that's going to ensue there? Excuse me, boys and girls, but no, I cannot imagine the chaos that would result from Americans withdrawing, because I don't think it could get any worse than it is right now, can it? I mean, you're killing 3,700 people a month in Baghdad, a city of about 6 million people. Let me just divide that out. 3,700 divided by 6 million. Well, that's really not very many. It's only 0.0006%. What's that? 6 out of 1,000. 6 out of 1,000 per month times 12. 0.007. I guess that's 7 per 1,000. 7 per 1,000, 007 per year. So statistically, I guess it's not very many, the 3,700 a month. But Saddam Hussein never killed 3,700 a month, did he? I never heard of anything like that. Nobody ever reported Saddam Hussein, the butcher of Baghdad's killing 3,000 people a month, but that's how many people are being killed, not by Americans, not by American troops per se, but by the insurgents. Now, you had that going on in Vietnam until the Americans left. Once the Americans left, the North came down, defeated the South, and then they had peace. So here's the way I would see Iraq. We leave, and they'll go into immediate civil war, and they'll fight it out until one side beats the other side. And then once one side wins, then you'll have peace. As long as the Americans are there trying to keep the Shiites and the Sunnis apart, you'll always have war. You'll have war today, tomorrow, next week, next year, and 25 years from now. That's what you had in Vietnam. That's what you had in China. As far as I can tell, that's the way that game is played. So when I hear the president say, or I hear these guys on the Lair News Hour say, well, my God, can you imagine what's going to happen, the chaos and so on if we leave? If we leave, we leave losers, that's all. Have you ever been in a bar and some guy just beat the living hell out of you. And, you know, when it was all said and done, you got up and you walked out of the bar. Okay, so you lost another fight. It wasn't the first time you ever got whipped and probably won't be the last. You know, you don't win every fight, do you? I don't know, maybe some guys do, you know. Maybe they're a Muhammad Ali, but, you know, I've been around the block a couple of times, kids, and I noticed that, remember I told you this already, I said you go into the bar and you go butt into somebody else's conflict and you probably are going to get a nosebleed. If you go into the bar, you sit down at the end, drink your drink, and then get up and walk out, you probably won't have any problems. Now, you know, we haven't been messing with the North Koreans lately, and I suppose if we don't mess with the North Koreans too much, they probably won't have a problem with them, but if we go up there and we mess with them, we'll probably have a problem. We went over there and messed with the Iraqis, and now we got a problem. Now, so far, we haven't messed with the Iranians, but we're over there trying real hard. Now, I suppose if we keep pushing, keep messing with them, maybe we can get another war started over in Iran. Again, I pointed this out before, you know, if you don't mess with people, they don't cause you a problem. If you mess with them, you get a problem. Which leads me to the conclusion, if you'll mind your own business for a change, you might be able to alleviate a lot of those problems. Americans, that's going to be hard for you to do. Americans have got their nose in everybody's business. We've got troops stationed in 127 countries around the world. Did you know that? 127 countries have troops in them. My God, if the Russians or the Chinese had troops in 50 countries around the world, President Bush would be saying we're on the verge of a communist takeover. I wonder what the rest of the people in the world think. Are they on the verge of an American takeover? Maybe that's what they're fighting so hard to prevent. All right, so let's take a look at number 10, the tendency toward argument by intimidation. Extremists tend to frame their arguments in such a way as to intimidate others into accepting their premises and their conclusions. Isn't that what the president's doing over here, trying to intimidate us by telling us if we leave Iraq before the mission is accomplished? Is there anybody out there that can tell me what the hell the mission is? What is it that we're going to accomplish by staying in Iraq for 25 more years? Let's see, if we can stay there for 25 more years at $3,700 a month times 12 months times 25 years, we can kill 1,110,000 Iraqis. We should be able to kill one out of every six Iraqis in Baghdad in the next 25 years. When we get through, what have we gained by doing that? If we stayed the course. Is that the objective? Let's see. We've been there for 3 years, killed 3,000 Americans. If we kill 1,000 a year times 25 years, the death count will be 25,000. I saw the other day that the wounded were 20,000 times 25 years would be 500,000 wounded. So you got 25,000 dead, 500,000 Americans injured in 25 years. When you get through, you stayed the course, you get to the end of it, then what have you got? Because if that's your objective, then you should stay the course. On the other hand, I'm sitting over here saying, well, what in the hell are we doing that for? The president said the other day that what we needed was to have an Iraq that could stand on their own two feet. Excuse me. We got whipped in Vietnam, and when we left Vietnam, the North came down and whipped the South, and they've got peace. Boys and girls, my common sense tells me when we leave Iraq, which at some point in time we're going to leave. At some point. I don't know when, but at some point. When we leave, the Shiites are going to whip the Sunnis, and when they get through, they'll have peace. And as long as the Americans were in Vietnam, there was no peace. And as long as the French were in Vietnam, there was no peace. And as long as the Americans and the NATO forces are in Afghanistan and Iraq, there'll be no peace. Now, if you want continued conflict and more war to generate more and more dollars worth of defense funds for Halliburton, Bechtel, Boeing, Northrop, and North American, and Lockheed Martin, by God, you're on the right track. I can't think of a better way to make money for the defense industry than to stay the course. so let's stick with it. Number 11 calls for the use of slogans, buzzwords, and thought-stopping cliches. For many extremists, shortcuts in thinking and in reasoning in matters out seems to be necessary in order to avoid or evade awareness of troublesome facts and compelling counterarguments. Isn't that what this Baker Commission came up with? Hey, Mr. President, your stay the course program ain't working. Been in this war now longer than we were in World War II. I agreed, though, with the president that the Baker Commission, you know, they said, well, let's go to the Iranians and the Syrians. Excuse me. But you walk into the bar, you walk up to these two guys, you butt into their conversation, they beat the hell out of you, and then you say, well, I didn't do well there, so I think I'll go over here and I'll butt into somebody else's conversation. They beat the hell out of you. And so you say, well, what I need to do is to go back to the first two guys that beat the hell out of me and have serious negotiations with them to negotiate a peace settlement with the second two guys that I butted into. It's beyond me. I'm not quite sure where these people are coming from. They all go to college. They get degrees after their names. Honest to God, kids, do you think that you could walk up to some guy that's your arch enemy? I can't think of anybody that hates us more than the Syrians, the North Koreans, or the Iranians. Can you name any other country in the world that would hate us more than that? Or any or all of those three? And you're going to go to who? To help you solve a beef with another one of your enemies that you butted into his conversation on? You know, I heard that from that Baker Commission when the president said, I don't think that's very viable. I got to agree with Bush that I don't think that makes any sense at all. And these people, kids, they all go to college and get degrees after their names. You can try this. Yeah, you ought to test it. If you think that's got any merit, you just walk into the blue room, walk up to some guy, pick a bitch with him, and then get into a big fight and whip him. Just beat the living hell out of him. Okay. Now you vanquished that guy. Now go pick a fight with some big guy over here. I mean, the first guy, you want to pick some little wimpy guy that ain't very big. Just go over and beat the hell out of him. Okay, now go over and pick a fight with some big guy. Some big truck driver over here, and when this big truck driver has you down on the ground, he's just kicking the living snot out of you, then go over to this first guy that you just whipped over there and said, hey, would you come over here and negotiate a settlement with me? I say, honest to God, kids, and these people go to college to learn this kind of crap? All right. Enough said on that number 10 and 11. Let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. And if you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the webpage as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Remember, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And in addition, we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, newsletters, and so on to our listeners. Keep in mind, though, that these endorsements or recommendations that we give out don't mean that those authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are going to reciprocate and endorse or recommend the Law Hour and editorial review. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. We are reviewing Extremist Traits by Laird Wilcox. You can get a copy of this report. It's www.webtattoo, all one word, just webtattoo, webtattoo.com. Then go to /Wilcox/hoax project, and that'll give you these extremist traits, about 20 of them. I thought they were pretty interesting, and I thought I'd give you a report because it looks like to me that our president, George Bush, fits each and every one of them. And George Bush, Donald Rumsfeld, and Dick Cheney, without a doubt, fit these extremist traits. Now, it may well be that Osama bin Laden and the whole Muslim world also meet these same extremist traits. I'm not picking sides. I just wanted to report to you that we got some extremists over here on our side as well as there is on the other side. Number 12, assumption of moral or other superiority over others. Most obvious would be claims of general racial or ethnic superiority, a master race, for example. Less obvious are claims of ennoblement because of alleged victimhood, a special relationship with God, membership in a special elite or class, and a kind of aloof, high-minded snobbishness that accrues because of the weightiness of their preoccupations, their altruism, and their willingness to sacrifice themselves and others to their cause. After all, who can bear to deal with common people when one is trying to save the world? Extremists can show great indignation when one is insensitive enough to challenge these claims. And my president, hardly a day goes by that I'm watching the news that he doesn't say, well, I'm here to protect the American people. Well, excuse me, but looking up my hiney when I go to get on an airplane isn't protecting me. It isn't protecting anybody else. It's an intrusion into my God-given rights, and I object to it. And that's why I don't fly on airplanes anymore. I quit. I'll take my money and walk before I'll get on a damn airplane. Unless until they change their tune, and that isn't very likely. But they're trying to protect us, and they're using these extremist traits in their high-minded snobbishness. I mean, if I walked into the airport and said, what in the hell are you guys running around in this airport with these AK-47s and these submachine guns? Have you watched what's going on in your local community with all these cameras that are shining down on you like in London, England? It's the most surveillance-prone city in the world, London, England. Got cameras on every street corner. You English people over there, you like that, do you? Hell, Adolf Hitler never had any kind of a program like that. Hell, Joe Stalin and Genghis Khan and Mao Zedong, they could only dream of that kind of a socialist welfare state of such complete and total observation of their subject. Hell, I don't even have that in my chicken house. And they got it in London, though. And they got it in our airports everywhere. And our president, of course, he's over here telling us, after all, who can bear to deal with common people when one is trying to save the world? Isn't that what our president is trying to do? Save the world? I haven't heard of Osama bin Laden trying to save the world. Last time I heard, he was trying to throw the damn Americans, the Satanists, out of their Middle Eastern countries. Well, you know, if I was in a bar and I was having trouble with the patrons in there, I think I'd leave the bar and take my business someplace else. Now, if the guys in the bar followed me to the new bar, I would say, well, now they're butting into my business. But, you know, I would submit to you that if the Anglo-Saxons just left the Middle East, we just got up and walked out, what the hell would be the problem with that? Now, I know somebody's going to write me an email and they're going to say, oh, my God, where would we get our oil? How about Wyoming, Utah, and Colorado, where we have 3.6 trillion barrels of the stuff sitting in oil shale out there that costs about $30 to $40 a barrel to get it out? Why don't we come over here and develop our own oil and let the Arabs develop theirs? I know it's unfair, and when God divided up the oil wealth of the world, he put all of the Canadians' oil wealth in tar sands, put our oil wealth in oil shale, and he gave the Arabs all of the liquid oil, and all they got to do is poke a hole in the ground. But, you know, that's the breaks of the game. Take it up with God in the judgment and tell him, hey, listen, you were unfair to us. But meanwhile, he didn't cut us out. We've got more oil in the United States and Canada than all the rest of the world combined. Maybe 10 times over. The total known oil wealth in the Middle East only represents about 60 or 70% of the known oil reserves, which is only 1 trillion barrels. They only got 600 or 700 billion barrels. We got 3.6 trillion. That's 3,600 billion. They've only got 700. So we haven't been left out. We've got plenty of oil over here, and we don't even need Standard Oil or Exxon or Shell or anybody else to develop it. We were developing oil shale in this country since before 1900 and getting oil out of it and using it. Did you know that? And if we could do it with little entrepreneurs out there in Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming in 1900, I'll just bet you we could do it in 2006. And to hell with the big oil companies. It ain't going to happen. I'll agree with you there. It ain't going to happen. But if we did, we'd have a whole lot more peace because we don't need their oil. I think Exxon and Standard Oil needs their oil. I think Boeing and Halliburton and Kellogg Brown and Root needs their oil. I think they need it for their profits and their corporate bottom lines. But Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife and the average Iraqi or the average Muslim doesn't need it. Doesn't need it. And then these extremists have doomsday thinking. That's number 13. Extremists often predict dire or catastrophic consequences from a situation or from failure to follow a specific course. And they tend to exhibit a kind of crisis-mindedness. It can be a communist takeover, a Nazi revival, nuclear war, earthquakes, floods, or the wrath of God. Whatever it is, it's just around the corner unless we follow their program and unless we listen to these special insights and special wisdom that is displayed by these extremists to which only the truly enlightened have access. For these extremists, any setback or defeat is the beginning of the end. Now take a look at George Bush's behavior here. Let's think about doomsday thinking. When I'm watching the Lehrer News Hour at night, they'll have two sides come on there. The one guy, he's a Democrat, he says, let's cut and run, and the other guy says, let's stay the course. And I'm sitting here saying, do we need to make this choice, cut and run, or stay the course? Is there any other answer to this problem? Is there a third, fourth, or a fifth solution to this? And so, of course, here's our president. He says, well, them Democrats over there, they're just cut and run cowards. You know, they got a yellow streak up their back. And I'm sitting over here saying, well, after you've stayed there for 25 more years, what are you gonna have at the end of 25 years that you don't already have today? Are you going to have fewer casualties? I mean, they're killing about 3 Americans a day over there, aren't they? About 3 a day. Which in total terms is chicken feed. It doesn't even come up on the radar screen. My God, the Normandy invasion killed thousands a day. So forget about the 3 casualties or the 3 guys getting killed every day. That doesn't come up on the radar screen. Are we going to end up with their 100 billion barrels of oil? Are we going to have any more money at the end of 25 years of stay the course than we have already today? I mean, kids, we've already spent, they're telling us now that we've already spent over there $500 billion, and that it's going to cost us another $500 billion if we left in the morning. You got to pay all these veterans' benefits, and you got to pay all this debt and the interest on the debt for all the money that you borrowed to conduct the war already. So here you're in the deal, $1 trillion. And what are you fighting over? Well, you're fighting over about 125 or 130 billion barrels of oil. So let's see. Now we're going to spend $1,000 billion for 100 billion. You got 100 billion barrels of oil, and you're going to spend 1,000. Let me see how much that is. So we got a trillion. That's one. I'll just put in a trillion. My little sharp EL1197. You know, when we get up into billions and trillions, we can't handle those kind of numbers. And so, just being a plumber and all, I gotta shorten this up a little bit. So if we just took 100 over there and divided that by 10. We got $10 a barrel that we've already bought and paid for in that oil over there, and they're producing oil over there at a lower rate than they did with Saddam Hussein, and they're having to import gasoline into Iraq. Can you believe this? They've got electricity 4 hours a day in Baghdad, and they got sewer water running down the streets. And then the other day, they built a building over there, if you can believe this. I've forgotten now who built it. It was some corporation down in Los Angeles, got this government contract to build a police headquarters or a training facility for the Iraqi police. And I don't know how many of the joints, but nearly every joint in the plumbing system in the building leaks. And so now they've got leaking plumbing all over the building. And I said, well, what the hell do you expect? You got this American corporation that goes over there with a no-bid contract. They hire a bunch of scab plumbers out of the Philippines and take them over there that don't know how to use a rigid pipe wrench or how to use a rigid pipe wrench to glue up a plastic joint, and then they plumb this building in and it leaks. What do you think of that? And then I heard the other day they lost $9 billion over there. How in the hell do you lose $9 billion? I mean, I can see somebody stealing it. They've lost it. They don't know if it's stolen. They don't know if it was given away. They don't know if it was spent. It's just a black hole. It just disappeared. $9 billion. I'm going, how in the hell do you lose $9 billion? But they did. I don't know if Kellogg Brown and Root or Bechtel or or Halliburton or somebody ended up with the money. And now they expect us to pay this borrowed money back at interest. I guess that money is being borrowed by God knows who, and I'm going to be indebted for the rest of my life and my children's lives, you know, to pay this back. I said to hell with that a long time ago. I'm not interested in buying into that program. And I'm not interested in buying into this doomsday thinking, but this is what the extremists are selling us every day on the 6 o'clock news. Katie Couric comes over there. This Howard Commission, this Baker Commission, they come in. We got this doomsday prognostication for Iraq. You know, it's dire, it's grave, and it's getting worse. And then you got the president say, well, you got the cut and run Democrats over there, and we got to stay the course. And I'm sitting here saying, I think all three of these guys have been in college for so damn long that none of them can think. There isn't one of them there at the table that's got a lick of common sense. Children, wake up to reality. If you packed up and left in the morning, which is what you did in Vietnam, do you remember? There was a day when you packed up and got the hell out. Remember that? So then what happened? Did the world come to an end? No. Did the world turn communist? No. Didn't they tell you the world was going to come to an end and that the world was going to go communist if we left Vietnam? Yep, that's what they told you. And so what did Wilcox tell us here? He said, well, number 13, extremists always believe in doomsday thinking. Extremists often predict dire or catastrophic consequences from a situation or from failure to follow a specific course. And your president says, if we don't stay the course, the end of the world is coming. Well, yeah, you're going to get a black eye, a bloody nose, and you're going to get whooped, and you're going to get thrown out. And so, okay, so what the hell is the big problem? 'Tain't the first time you ever got whipped, won't be the last. And if you had stayed out of this fight to start with, you wouldn't have got whipped this time. Which leads me to an old proverb that I learned years ago, and that is, you can stay out of a whole lot more trouble than you can get out of after the fact. My old daddy, you know, used to have some wise old sayings. He told me one time, he said, son, if you get into a fight with somebody, you don't ever want to tell that guy you're going to knock him on his ass, because if you do, you'll never get the job done. He said, what you do, son, is you just knock him on his ass, and when he's down on the ground, bleeding, unless he's brain dead, he'll be able to figure out what happened. He said, now when he's down, get on top of him and don't let that sucker get up, because if he ever gets up, it might be the end of the fight for you. Now, we had them Iraqis down. Remember, we walked in there in about, I don't know, was it 3 weeks or something like that? You whipped them. And that was the time for you to make a graceful exit. That was the when you knocked him down, you knocked a couple of teeth loose, and he was bleeding from both ends, and you said, okay, sucker, now don't do that again, or we'll have another bitch. And then you leave. You know, we could have walked out of Iraq at that point in time, and we would all have been heroes. You messed with us, we messed with you. When it was all said and done, we ate your lunch. End of the report. It's the end of the argument. Well, so much for doomsday thinking. Now, number 14, he says, belief that it's okay to do bad things in the service of a good cause. Hey, excuse me, but isn't that what we saw at Abu Ghraib? Isn't it okay to torture these prisoners over here so that we can get information out of these people so that we can save American lives? I mean, you're only losing three a day. Let's see, three a day. 3,700 a month. Let's figure this out. 3,700 Iraqis in Baghdad alone divided by 30 days is 123 a day. And now we lose three Americans a day, and the Iraqis are losing 123. So that's about, divided by three, that's about 41 to 1, isn't it? 41 more Iraqis die every day than Americans. And I'm not over here defending one side or the other. I'm just making observations, kids. Because it sounds like that our president and our secretary of defense and our vice president are extremists to me. And it seems like to me that they meet these standards, and so far I'm up to number 14. Number 14. And so far every single one of these extremist traits fits our president, our secretary of defense, and our vice president. And not to mention our secretary of state and 55,000 other people in the Bush administration. But those seem to be the top three guys over there. And I haven't heard these same 20 extremist traits coming out of Osama bin Laden. I mean, he may be 10 times worse than Bush, which brings us back to this extremist trait where you've got two extremists on each side of this extreme position. Neither side is paying attention to the other. Now, the Baker Commission comes along and says, well, maybe we better give some consideration to these extremists over here, the insurgents. Well, duh. Oh my God. Maybe we should give some consideration to Ho Chi Minh and the Viet Cong. Well, when did you wake up to that realization that maybe we should listen to what these guys are complaining about? Would seem like to me that maybe we could have avoided a whole lot more trouble in Vietnam when the French got kicked out at Bien Dien Phu. I don't think we needed to go in there and pick up somebody else's bitch. Go into a bar sometime. Test this. See if it doesn't have some merit to it. Walk into a bar. Pretty soon, there's going to be a bitch. Some guy is going to get in a fight with somebody, and they're over there just fighting and just really getting after it, see? And pretty soon, one guy is going to win the fight. Now, you go over and pick a fight with that guy. And see how that benefits you. And you're sitting there saying, well, why would I want to get in a fight with that guy? That was my question. After the North Vietnamese had whipped the French in 1954, why did the Americans need to go over and get into a fight with the winner? How did that benefit us in any way? So after 58,000 Americans get killed over in Vietnam, somebody wakes up one day and says, well, gee, maybe we better go to the Paris Peace Conference and start talking peace with the Viet Cong. And my question is, well, why did you go get in a fight with the Viet Cong to start with? I mean, if you wanted to get in a fight with somebody and defeat communism, you could have started in your own backyard down here in Cuba with Fidel Castro. Seems like to me it'd be a hell of a lot easier to whip the communists in Cuba than it is to go over on the other side of the world 12,000 miles and go pick a fight with somebody that just whipped your buddy over here, the French. And then we've got this number 14, the belief that it's okay to do bad things in the service of a good cause. You know, extremists may deliberately lie, distort, misquote, slander, defame, or libel their opponents and or critics, and engage in censorship or repression. Oh my God, censorship, repression, or undertake violence in special cases. This is done with little or no remorse as long as it's in the service of defeating the communists, or defeating the fascists, or defeating the extremists. Defeating an enemy becomes an all-encompassing goal in which other values are subordinate. With extremists, the ends justify the means. Isn't that what we see down in Guantanamo? They got 600 guys locked up down there. And those 600 guys down there are probably all bad guys. Let's give Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld credit where credit's due. The 600 guys they got down there are all bad guys. Good. Let's put them on trial, which is the standard that we Anglo-Saxons have always used, or at least have since 1215 at Magna Carta at Runnymede. And let's put them on trial, and let's present witnesses, evidence, and testimony. And let's convict these guys, and then let's take them out and hang them, each and every one of them. Because they all deserve it, because they're all bad guys. But what is this locking these guys up and then hiding them away from the Red Cross and denying them access to a lawyer and denying them a trial, denying them access to witnesses for their defense or the ability to cross-examine their accusers or to present evidence in their defense? What in the hell is that all about? What has that got to do with America or Americanism or Anglo-Saxon administration? Can you tell me that? It's way beyond me. I thought that was something that we got out of the Nazis and the communists and Joe Stalin and Genghis Khan and Mao Zedong. I thought that's the way they behaved because they were extreme. Now I find that my president is acting the way the extremists behave, and that's why I believe that George Bush is an extremist. All right, I'm out of time here, so let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. And the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information about our homeschooling program, then go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Hey, we're out of time. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.